Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the show, we'll find out how AI and tech companies like Amazon and utility giant PG&E are spending big money to influence California lawmakers and prevent stricter regulations on data centers. But first, we turn to the devastating glacier collapse on the Nepal-Tibet border, which has killed more than 1,200 people. More than 4,000 are still missing. In his opinion piece in the New York Times called Mountains Are Coming Undone, today's guest, Jonathan Mingle, writes, quote, "This is a sign of a new disorienting danger in cold mountain zones, the rapid destabilization of glaciers and permafrost that can remake entire landscapes in the blink of an eye. The processes leading to these cascading failures are complex, but the hidden hand behind them is human-caused climate change. Our fossil fuel burning is pulling down the world's highest peaks," end quote. So are the media connecting the dots and explaining the role that burning fossil fuels has played in bringing us to this point? Jonathan Mingle is an independent journalist and author of two books, including Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and The Fight for America's Energy Future. Jonathan Mingle is a McGraw Fellow at CUNY's Craig Newmark School of Journalism. His reporting has been featured in many outlets, including the New York Review of Books and Yale Environment 360. You can read his New York Times op-ed at klw.org, click news, and your call. Hi, John. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Well, you have been to this region, and what happened is just devastating to watch these videos of homes and communities being destroyed. It happened so fast, people didn't have time to react. Fossil fuels account for about 90% of human-caused carbon dioxide emissions. So first off, what are your thoughts on the major media's role in connecting the dots and providing context about the underlying causes of all of this?
Yeah, you know, I would say, as with a lot of coverage of some of the extreme weather events we've seen in recent years, it's a mixed bag. Some outlets have done a good job of connecting those dots, including NPR. And some have been a little delayed or not as clear as they could be in making those connections for their listeners and their readers. But I think, you know, we do have to pause and acknowledge that this event, this calamity, which is really hard to put into words, the images and the reports coming out of Nepal and Tibet, the speed, the ferocity, the scale of it, and it's still unfolding. You know, as you mentioned, there are 4,000 people still missing. It's a complex, you know, region, rapidly changing, remote area, hard to monitor. So scientists who study this part of the Himalaya will tell you we're still piecing together what happened. And, you know, there are microclimates and mountain slope dynamics and all kinds of factors that they will study in the coming months. But as I wrote in the piece, they will also tell you that the trends are unmistakable. You know, the Himalaya are warming quite rapidly, and the rate at which glaciers are disappearing is accelerating. That's just fact. You know, Himalayan glaciers are losing mass 10 times faster in the past few decades than they have over the past millennium or so. So that is the background against which this tragic event has unfolded. And I do think it's important for the media, for media outlets to connect those dots.
As I said, you visited the area 15 years ago. You're very familiar with the region. You were reporting on vanishing glaciers for your first book. So can you tell us more about the region and the communities, the people who live there?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible place. I was there in 2011, and I was in the midst of reporting for my first book, Fire and Ice, which was largely about, you know, the causes and consequences of glacier retreat in the Himalayas. And I started that journey, that particular journey, in Siapfru Besi, a town which is now largely erased by this terrible flood. And I, you know, trekked up below the mountain Langtung Lirung, whose north flank partially collapsed. And that is what caused this event. You know, I was in a village that in 2015 was erased by another terrible rock ice avalanche event. That one was triggered by the earthquake that struck Nepal in April 2015. That village was in the path of basically a rock glacier collapse on the south flank of the same mountain whose north side we just saw fail, give way, not because of an earthquake, but what seems to be a result of, as I said, complex dynamics, but in a way, you could think of it as the simplest, most obvious impact of climate change you could imagine, which is that as temperatures go up, as it gets hotter, ice melts. And something that scientists know quite well is that in the high mountains of the world, there's permafrost, right? And it knits together the soil and rock on these mountain flanks. And as the glaciers retreat, due to climate change, they expose these dark rock flanks. The meltwater infiltrates cracks and freezes and widens them and melts again. And these kinds of dynamics can, over time, we can't see it, it's hidden to our monitoring tools, but suddenly cause a mountainside to give way. So, you know, I was in these communities, people incredibly welcoming, people who had witnessed changes over the course of their lives that they were very blunt, you know, and telling me about. You know, they see the glaciers retreating before their very eyes. They're aware of their own vulnerability to floods, especially from glacial lake outburst floods, which is a phenomenon that's been on the radar of planners and government officials for decades. You know, as a glacier melts, it retreats, the meltwater fills the basin that it is left behind, and at some point can overtop or burst through its natural dam and threaten communities downstream. That threat is being mapped. There are inventories, there's satellite monitoring. People in these communities are aware of these risks. But that isn't what happened in Nepal last week. What happened was a mountain coming apart. And that is, you know, as I wrote in the piece, it's a new, frightening kind of risk that hasn't really been on our radar screen, but it's a testament to how fast the climate is changing in this part of the world.
And what's so devastating about this, we've done so many shows about the people who have contributed the least amount to the climate crisis, in many cases, are getting hit the hardest. So in the case of Nepal, Nepal has contributed less than 0.1% of historical global greenhouse gas emissions. Its per capita emissions remain among the lowest in the world. And yet they are paying a very high price. Sunil Acharya, an international climate policy and just transition specialist in Kathmandu, wrote a piece in The Guardian, and he writes, "People in Nepal and Tibet must not pay the price with their lives, livelihoods, and money meant for education and health for global heating caused by wealthy states." So this is such a difficult question. In the case of Nepal, for example, and Tibet, how are people and governments supposed to prepare for what's to come?
I'm glad you brought this up, because it's absolutely right that Nepal has done virtually nothing. You know, people in Nepal have contributed next to nothing to cause this climate crisis. But they are one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate impacts. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you know, I think they rank 160th, you know, in of all the world's countries in terms of their CO2 emissions. And, you know, to just really throw the contours of this injustice into sharp relief, consider the response of the United States to this tragedy. We are the largest historical emitter of carbon. I think our government initially offered $500,000 in aid as, you know, the disaster response kicked into gear. I widely, you know, pilloried and just called out around the world for it's just an absurdly small number given our historic responsibility for climate change, you know, global climate change, which is now being visited upon people who not only did little to cause it, but have limited resources to adapt to it. And I would emphasize that point just because I think these kinds of events reveal the hard limits of adaptation. How do you adapt to something like this? You know, this is a flood that was several stories high of mud, debris, rock. It traveled 100 miles per hour, 60 miles downstream, wiping out entire towns. I think something like 14 hydroelectric facilities were damaged or destroyed. Nepal was counting on, including six that were under construction, counting on those facilities as not only a source of electricity for their own people, but revenue to export that power to India. And all gone. And the workers, we hope some of them have survived in the tunnels. They're trying to be rescued as we speak. Nepal can't afford to move its people out of harm's way. There will surely be other events like this, right? As it just keeps getting warmer and warmer. And as the glaciers keep shrinking and fragmenting and the permafrost holding the mountains together keeps coming unglued. Who's going to help them pay for all that? To recover, to rebuild, to adapt. You know, the initial estimates that I've seen are, and this will probably go up, $5 billion to recover and rebuild in this one valley of Nepal. That's a tenth of their economy, right? And what's particularly shameful, not just the really inadequate immediate response of the U.S. government, but the fact that, you know, last year, under the Trump administration, the United States withdrew from the UN's Climate Loss and Damage Fund, which is designed for precisely this kind of scenario, to help vulnerable countries adapt to the fast-changing climate. And not only that, but DOGE, let us not forget, as part of its shuttering of USAID, our Foreign Assistance International Aid Agency, they also ended a program, a long-running collaboration with NASA, that helped organizations in Himalayan countries use satellites and other tools to monitor landslides and glacier change and flood risk. And that was canceled. That was shut down last year, right? And that was the kind of program, the kind of investment that was designed to help communities get out of harm's way from these kinds of events.
I'm glad you brought this up because The Independent had a piece about this and they quoted Jeremy Condyke, who ran the USAID response to the 2015 Nepal earthquake. He said, it's hard to say if this program could have been able to foresee this particular flooding event, but doing so was its purpose. He went on to say, sadly, it's hard to anticipate or mitigate climate hazards, which your ideology has decreed do not exist. You know, Jonathan, when we're putting the show together, I mean, we're going to talk about AI in our next segment and all of these AI companies and tech companies spending a lot of money to ensure that data centers are not regulated. And I was thinking, wow, I can go on my computer and ask any question and get all kinds of answers and links from AI by default. And yet they're shutting down these services that could possibly at least help scientists to figure out when something like this is going to happen, or at least to give them the data that they need. I mean, this administration is getting rid of so much crucial data.
Yeah, and this is a data challenge part of the world, right? You know, one of the themes of my first book, which is I spent a lot of time reporting in India, Nepal, Bhutan, parts of Tibet about the risks associated with this accelerating glacial retreat. And, one of the themes that came out in my reporting is that, people are doing heroic work to study these changes in these difficult environments in high mountain areas. But there are big gaps, big blind spots, right? And now we have these tools, remote sensing, that they help us, piece together in the days after this flood in Nepal, what happened. Those are the same tools that could theoretically help create early warning systems, right? There are warning systems for communities downstream of these glacial lakes, which, as I mentioned, are being mapped and inventoried. And I witnessed a glacial lake outburst flood in northwest India when I was reporting my book. I talked to people who had survived those floods in Nepal and Bhutan. It's a risk that's, it's known, even though these lakes are growing fast, they're growing in number, it's hard to keep up with the rate of change. This kind of permafrost, ungluing mountains themselves risk, that is much harder to track and takes resources, right? But here, as you point out, we have these phenomenal tools at our fingertips, but we're not deploying them to follow the greatest risks, it seems.
On today's Your Calls Media Roundtable, we're talking about the devastating flash floods on the Nepal-Tibet border with Jonathan Mingle, an independent journalist, author of two books, who wrote a New York Times opinion piece called Mountains Are Coming Undone. And in your piece, you write that worldwide, climate change is causing glaciers to disappear at an accelerating rate. Few places are as vulnerable as the Himalaya and the Tibetan Plateau, where the rate of glacier ice loss has doubled since 2000. As those frozen water towers dwindle, the 2 billion people downstream who depend on the great rivers of Asia will have less water for drinking, farming, and hydroelectricity in decades to come. Most people will be exposed to glacial lake outburst floods. It's incredible to think about this, John, that we're talking here about 2 billion people.
Yeah, I mean it's what it's a quarter of humanity almost. And yeah, that's how many people depend directly or indirectly on the seasonal flow of meltwater from snow and ice in the Himalaya in the Tibetan Plateau. And my first book was largely about a community in the Zanskar Valley of northwest India that was forced to abandon their 1,000-year-old village because they were running out of water. And that was kind of the story at the heart of the book. In a way, their story, it offers a preview of what's coming across the region later this century, right? So the best, estimates are that glacial runoff, right? So melting of Himalayan glaciers will probably peak around mid-century. After that, the water storage function of the snow and ice on those mountains will decline. It won't be there as a buffer, as a source of seasonal irrigation water, drinking water for people, both immediately downstream, but even think of the huge cities, along the Ganges, Brahmaputra, Indus River, Mekong, Yangtze, Yellow River. These are enormously consequential changes for that part of the world. And I still don't think, I still marvel at the fact a decade after that book came out, like it is really not something that percolates up, the policy agenda, even in these countries, countries like India, where researchers are tracking this, doing great work to warn policymakers about the risks. I'm still amazed that it's not a bigger story.
Well, to your point, I'm glad you raised this because here are a couple other headlines that just came out. This is from the New York Times, Chico Harlan, a couple days ago. Climate goals missed. UN says world must now remove carbon at scale. The Guardian, again, a couple days ago by Damian Carrington, supersizing before our eyes. UN warns of record El Nino approaching. Event is likely to be largest in at least 1,000 years and will pile extra heat into a world already in a climate crisis. So as this is all happening, for sure there's great climate coverage going on across the board, but the coverage is down. So Yale has taken a look, or I'm sorry, Yale 360 reported on this. The data comes from the University of Colorado. They found that climate coverage is down across the board. In 2025, it was down 14% in 2024, 38% 2021. So, at a time when we need this news, the coverage is dipping. What do you think explains that?
I think it's a short-sighted response to, shifting political winds. When you see NPR shut down its climate desk or the Washington Post lay off much of its excellent climate team, it's hard not to shake your head at the short-sightedness of it, right? I mean, it's the biggest story in the world and will be for the foreseeable future. And those outlets have done great work. CNN, they laid off some of their climate team. On one level, you scratch your head and you're like, you're missing the huge story, a huge opportunity. But on another level, it makes sense. You think about editors chasing what they think, the zeitgeist is, and the zeitgeist has shifted away, purportedly, from climate stories and climate issues. Some people call it climate hushing, and you see this with certain formerly very engaged corporations, nonprofits, even environmental groups, retreating from not only climate commitments, but even talking about it. I think, others have pointed this out, but unfortunately, this super El Nino we're about to experience may shift that pendulum back in the other direction. If some of the impacts are as extreme as certain climate scientists are warning us, they might. But yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Even the Democratic Party is debating whether or not to talk about the climate crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased as a climate reporter, someone who follows this beat for a living. I think it's kind of silly. It doesn't make sense to me when you see surveys telling you that three quarters of Americans and close to 90% of people across other countries surveyed are concerned about climate change, right? And the fact that it's not their number one issue or top five doesn't mean they're not interested in it and interested in hearing more and reading more about it. There's always this debate after whether it's the Palisades fire or, an event like this in Nepal, just horrific disaster. To what extent can you link it to climate change? Or, if you talk about climate change being implicated in everything, does it dilute the force of that message? And to me, that's missing the point. The point is that climate change is loading the dice for all kinds of extreme weather events. Even your average th summer thunderstorm, where I live in Vermont, has now become a source of anxiety. We had terrible floods in 2023 and 2024 here, that some towns are still recovering from. Climate change is the background condition that is exacerbating natural variability. And so, as we wait to see analyses as to, what exactly was the chain of events that led to this terrible flood in Nepal and Tibet, I go back to what we were talking about earlier. On the far side of that complexity, we see the trends, they're clear as day. This part of the world is warming twice as fast as the global average. Himalayan glaciers are projected at current rates of warming, what we're on track for, to three quarters of their volume to be gone by the end of the century. And even at 1.5 degrees, which, as you said, the UN said this week, we're basically already committed to, we're basically there. even at 1.5 degrees, best case scenario, we lose 30 to 50% of Himalayan glacier ice.
Wow.
Now, that seems like something we should have started adapting to a while ago. But I think these events show us that, you know, not only are we not bracing for the impacts of that, there are impacts we haven't really anticipated. And that has tragic consequences.
Jonathan Mingle is an independent journalist and author of two books, including Gaslight, The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and The Fight for America's Energy Future. He's a McGraw Fellow at CUNY's Craig Newmark School of Journalism, and you can read his New York Times opinion piece called Mountains Are Coming Undone at KALW.org. Click news and your call. John, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back because every Monday, we cover all things climate. We've been doing this since the 2016 election. We felt like the media would probably not give these issues the attention they deserve. And so we're really dedicated to continuing this coverage. So thanks so much for your work. We'd love to have you back.
Well, thank you for your coverage. And I would love to join you again sometime.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll find out how AI and tech companies like Amazon and utility giant PG&E are spending big to influence California lawmakers and prevent stricter regulations on data centers. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.